Morphy paused. How do you mean? Oh, yes, I know. Yes, I do know. You believe I know? And every year, ever since I was a kid, only it gets worse because... maybe because I know more what it means. I hear those lonely Lama Sabachthani words. I do know, Ethan, I do. It's nearly over. Nearly over now, Ethan. Just forget I stomped out, will you? And the iron fire bell clanged, one single stroke. It's over now, said Joey Boy. It's all over, for a year. He drifted quietly out through the storeroom and eased the alley door shut. Ethan raised the shades and opened the store again, but there wasn't much trade. A few bottle of milk and loaf of bread kids, a small lamb chop and can of peas for Miss Borcher for her hot plate supper. People were just not moving about in the street. During the half hour before 6 o'clock, while Ethan was getting things ready to close up, not a soul came in. And he locked up and started away before he remembered the groceries for home. He had to go back and assemble them in two big bags and lock up over again. He had wanted to walk down to the bayside and watch the gray waves among the pilings of the dock, and smell the sea water, and speak to a seagull standing beak into the wind on a mooring float. He remembered a lady poem written long ago by someone whipped to a frenzy by the gliding spiral of a gull's flight. The poem began, "O happy fowl, what thrills thee so?" And the lady poet had never found out. Probably didn't want to know. The heavy bags of groceries for the holidays discouraged the walk. Ethan moved wearily across the high street and took his way slowly along Elm toward the old Holly house. Chapter 2 Mary came from the stove and took one of the big grocery bags from him. "I've got so much to tell you, I can't wait." He kissed her, and she felt the texture of his lips. "What's the matter?" she asked. "A little tired." "But you were closed 3 hours." "Plenty to do. I hope you aren't gloomy. It's a gloomy day." "It's been a wonderful day. Wait till you hear." "Where are the kids?"
"Upstairs with the radio. They've got something to tell you, too."
"Trouble?"
"Now why do you say that?"
"I don't know."
"You don't feel well."
"Damn it, I do too."
"With all the lovely things, I'll wait till after dinner for our part. Are you going to be surprised?"
Alan and Mary Ellen boiled down the stairs and into the kitchen.
"He's home," they said. "Pop, you got Peaks in the store?"
"You mean that cereal? Sure, Alan."
"I wish you'd bring some. It's the one with a mouse mask on the box that you cut out."
"Aren't you a little old for a mouse mask?"
Ellen said, "You send the box top and 10 cents and you get a ventriloquism thing and instructions. We just heard it on the radio."
Mary said,
"Tell your father what you want to do."
"Well, we're going to enter the National I Love America contest. First prize is to go to Washington, meet the president, with parents. Lots of other prizes." "Fine," said Ethan. "What is it? What do you have to do?"
"Hearst papers," Ellen cried, "all over the country. You just write an essay why you love America. All the winners get to go on television."
"It's the grapes," said Alan. "How about going to Washington? Hotel, shows, meet the president, the works. How's that for the grapes?" "How about your schoolwork?"
"It's this summer. They announce the winners 4th of July."
"Well, that might be all right. Do you really love America, or do you love prizes?"
"Now, father," said Mary, "don't go spoiling it for them."
"I just wanted to separate the cereal from the mouse mask. They get all mixed up."
"Pop, where would you say we could look it up?"
"Look it up?"
"Sure, like what some other guys said."
"Your great-grandfather had some pretty fine books. They're in the attic."
"Like what?"
"Oh, like Lincoln's speeches and Daniel Webster and Henry Clay.
You might take a look at Thoreau or Walt Whitman or Emerson. Mark Twain, too. They're all up there in the attic. Did you read them, Pop?
He was my grandfather.
He used to read them to me sometimes.
Maybe you could help us with the essays.
Then they wouldn't be yours.
Okay, said Alan. Will you remember to bring home some peaks? They're full of iron and stuff.
I'll try.
Can we go to the movies?
Mary said, I thought you were going to dye the Easter eggs. I'm boiling them now. You can take them out on the sun porch after dinner.
Can we go up in the attic and look at the books?
If you turn out the light after. Once it burned for a week. You left it on, Ethan.
When the children had gone, Mary said, Aren't you glad they're in the contest?
Sure, they do it right.
I can't wait to tell you. Margie read me in cards today. 3 times because she said she never saw anything like it. 3 times. I saw the cards come up myself.
Oh, Lord.
You won't be suspicious when you hear. You always poke fun about tall, dark strangers. You can't guess what it was about.
Well, you want to guess?
He said, Mary, I want to warn you.
Warn me? Why, you don't even know. My fortune is you.
He spoke a harsh, bitter word under his breath.
What did you say?
I said, Slim Pickens.
That's what you think, but that's not what the cards think. 3 times she threw them.
Cards think?
They know, said Mary. Here she read my cards, and it was all about you. You're going to be one of the most important men in this town. That's what I said, most important. And it's not going to be long, either. It's very soon. Every card she turned up showed money and more money. You're going to be a rich man.
Darling, he said, please let me warn you, please.
You're going to make an investment.
With what?
Well, I was thinking about brother's money.
No, he cried. I wouldn't touch it. That's yours, and it's going to stay yours.
Did you think that up, or did...
She never mentioned it, and the cards didn't.
You're going to invest in July, and from then on, it's one thing after another, one right after another. But don't it sound nice? That's the way she said it. Your fortune is Ethan. He's going to be a very rich man, maybe the biggest man in this town.
God damn her! She's got no right.
Ethan!
Do you know what she's doing? Do you know what you're doing?
I know I'm a good wife, and she's a good friend, and I don't want to quarrel with the children hearing. Margie Young is the best friend I've got. I know you don't like her. What I think is you're jealous of my friends. That's what I think. I had a happy afternoon, and you want to spoil it. That's not nice.
Mary's face was mottled with angry disappointment, and vengeful toward this obstacle to her daydreaming.
You just sit there, Mr. Smart, and tear people down. You think Margie made it all up? She didn't, because I cut the cards 3 times. But even supposing she did, why would she do it except to be kind and friendly and offer a little help? You tell me that, Mr. Smart. You find some nasty reason.
I wish I knew, he said. It might be pure mischief. She hasn't a man or a job. It might be mischief.
Mary lowered her voice and spoke with scorn. You talk about mischief. You wouldn't know mischief if it slapped you in the face. You don't know what Margie goes through. Why, there are men in this town after her all the time. Big men. Married men, whispering and urging. Nasty. Sometimes she don't know where to turn. That's why she needs me, a woman friend.
Oh, she told me things. Men you just wouldn't believe.
Why, some of them even pretend they don't like her in public, and then they sneak to her house or call her up and try to get her to meet them. Sanctimonious men, always preaching morals and then doing like that. You talk about mischief.
Did she say who they were?
No, she didn't, and that's another proof. Margie don't want to hurt anybody, even if they hurt her. But she said there was one I just wouldn't believe. She said it would turn my hair gray if I knew. Ethan took a deep breath and held it, and let it out as a huge sigh. "Wonder who it could be," Mary said. The way she said it was like it was somebody we knew well and just couldn't believe.
"But she would tell under certain circumstances," Ethan said softly.
"Only if she was forced. She said that herself. Only if she had to, if like her honor or her good name, you know. Who do you suppose it could be?"
"I think I know."
"You know? Who?"
"Me."
Her mouth fell open. "Oh, you fool," she said. "If I don't watch you, you trap me every time. Well, it's better than gloomy."
"A pretty kettle. Man confesses to sins of the flesh with wife's best friend. Is laughed to scorn.
That's not nice talk."
"Perhaps man should have denied it. Then at least his wife would have honored him with suspicion. My darling, I swear to you by all that's holy, that never by word or deed have I ever made a pass at Margie Young Hunt. Now will you believe I'm guilty?"
"You!"
"You don't think I'm good enough? Desirable enough, in other words? You don't think I could make the grade?"
"I like jokes. You know it. But that's not something to joke about."
"I hope the children haven't gotten into the trunks up there. They never put anything back." "I'll try once more, fair wife. A certain woman, initials M.Y.H., has surrounded me with traps, for reasons known only to herself. I'm in grave danger of falling into one or more of them."
"Why don't you think of your fortune? The card said July, and they said it three times. I saw it. You're going to get money, and lots of money. Think about that."
"Do you love money so much, Cottontail?"
"Love money? What do you mean?"
"Do you want money enough so that even necromancy, thaumaturgy, juju, or any other dark practices are justified?"
"You said it. You started it. I'm not going to let you hide in your words. Do I love money? No, I don't love money. But I don't love worry either. I'd like to be able to hold up my head in this town. I don't like the children to be hangdog because they can't dress as good, as well, as some others. I'd love to hold up my head."
"And money would prop up your head?"
"It would wipe the sneers off the faces of your holy la-di-das."
"No one sneers at Holly."
"That's what you think. You just don't see it."
"Maybe because I don't look for it."
"Are you throwing your holy Hollies up at me?"
"No, my darling. It's not much of a weapon anymore."
"Well, I'm glad you found it out. In this town or any other town, a Holly grocery clerk is still a grocery clerk."
"Do you blame me for my failure?"
"No. Of course I don't. But I do blame you for sitting wallowing in it. You could climb out of it if you didn't have your old-fashioned fancy-pants ideas. Everybody is laughing at you. A grand gentleman without money is a bum."
The word exploded in her head, and she was silent and ashamed. "I'm sorry," Ethan said. "You have taught me something. Maybe three things, rabbit footling mine. Three things will never be believed. The true, the probable, and the logical. I know now where to get the money to start my fortune."
"Where?"
"I'll rob a bank."
The little bell of the timer on the stove took up a slow-spaced pinging. Mary said, "Go call the children. The casserole's ready. Tell them to turn out the light."
She listened to his tread. Chapter 3. My wife, my Mary, goes to her sleep the way you would close the door of a closet. So many times I've watched her with envy. Her lovely body squirms a moment, as though she fitted herself into a cocoon. She sighs once, and at the end of it, her eyes close and her lips, untroubled, fall into that wise and remote smile of the ancient Greek gods.
She smiles all night in her sleep. Her breath purrs in her throat, not a snore, a kitten's purr. For a moment her temperature leaps up so that I can feel the glow of it beside me in the bed, then drops as she has gone away. I don't know where. She says she does not dream. She must, of course. That simply means her dreams do not trouble her, or trouble her so much that she forgets them before awakening. She loves to sleep, and sleep welcomes her. I wish it were so with me. I fight off sleep, at the same time craving it. I've thought the difference might be that my Mary knows she will live forever, that she will step from the living into another life as easily as she slips from sleep to wakefulness. She knows this with her whole body, so completely that she does not think of it any more than she thinks to breathe. Thus she has time to sleep, time to rest, time to cease to exist for a little. On the other hand, I know in my bones and my tissue that I will one day, soon or late, stop living, and so I fight against sleep and beseech it, even try to trick it into coming. My moment of sleep is a great wrench and agony. I know this because I have awakened at this second still feeling the crushing blow. And once in sleep, I have a very busy time. My dreams are the problems of the day, stepped up to absurdity, a little like men dancing wearing the horns and masks of animals. I sleep much less in time than Mary does. She says she needs a great deal of sleep, and I agree that I need less, but I am far from believing that. There's only so much energy stored in the body, augmented, of course, by foods. One can use it up quickly, the way some children gobble candy, or unwrap it slowly. There's always a little girl who saves part of her candy, and so has it when the gobblers have long since finished. I think my Mary will live much longer than I. She will have saved some of her life for later. Come to think of it, most women live longer than men. Good Friday has always troubled me. Even as a child, I was deep taken with sorrow, not at the agony of the crucifixion, but feeling the blighting loneliness of the crucified. And I've never lost the sorrow, planted by Matthew and read to me in the clipped, tight speech of my New England great-aunt Deborah. Perhaps it was worse this year. We do take the story to ourselves and identify with it. Today Murullo instructed me, so that for the first time I understood it, in the nature of business. Right afterward, I was offered my first bribe. That's an odd thing to say at my age, but I don't remember any other. I must think about Margie Young Hunt. Is she an evil thing? What is her purpose? I know she has promised me something, and has threatened me if I don't accept it. Can a man think out his life, or must he just tag along? So many nights I have lain awake, hearing my Mary's little purring beside me. If you stare into darkness, red spots start swimming on your eyes, and the time is long. Mary so loves her sleep that I have tried to protect her in it, even when the electric itch burned on my skin. She wakens if I leave the bed. It worries her. Because her only experience with sleeplessness has been illness, she thinks I'm not well. This night I had to get up and out. Her breath purred gently, and I could see the archaic smile on her mouth. Maybe she dreamed of good fortune, of the money I was about to make. Mary wants to be proud. It is odd how a man believes he can think better in a special place. I have such a special place, have always had it, but I know it isn't thinking I do there, but feeling and experiencing and remembering. It's a safety place. Everyone must have one, although I've never heard a man tell of it. Secret, quiet movement often awakens a sleeper when a deliberate normal action does not. Also, I'm convinced that sleeping minds wander into the thoughts of other people. I caused myself to need the bathroom, and when it was so, got up and went. And afterward I went quietly downstairs, carrying my clothes and dressed in the kitchen. Mary says I share other people's troubles that don't exist. Maybe that is so, but I did see a little possible scene play out in the dim-lighted kitchen. Mary awakening and searching the house for me, and her face troubled. I wrote a note on the grocery pad saying, "Darling, I'm restless. Have gone for a walk. Be back soon." I think I left it squarely in the center of the kitchen table, so that if the light was turned on at the wall switch, it would be the first thing seen. Then I eased the back door open and tasted the air. It was chilly, smelled of a crusting of white frost. I muffled up in a heavy coat and pulled a knitted sailor's cap down over my ears. The electric kitchen clock growled. It said 3:15. I'd been lying watching the red spots in the dark since 11. Our town of New Baytown is a handsome town, an old town, one of the first clear and defined whole towns in America. Its first settlers, and my ancestors, I believe, were sons of those restless, treacherous, quarrelsome, avaricious seafaring men who were a headache to Europe under Elizabeth, took the West Indies for their own under Cromwell, and came finally to roost on the northern coast, holding charters from the returned Charles Stuart. They successfully combined piracy and Puritanism, which aren't so unlike when you come right down to it. Both had a strong dislike for opposition, and both had a roving eye for other people's property. Where they merged, they produced a hard-bitten, surviving bunch of monkeys. I know about them because my father made me know. He was a kind of high amateur ancestor man, and I've always noticed that ancestor people usually lack the qualities of the ones they celebrate. My father was a gentle, well-informed, ill-advised, sometimes brilliant fool. Single-handed, he lost the land, money, prestige, and future. In fact, he lost nearly everything Allens and Hawleys had accumulated over several hundred years, lost everything but the names, which was all my father was interested in anyway. Father used to give me what he called heritage lessons. That's why I know so much about the old boys. Maybe that's also why I'm a clerk in a Sicilian grocery on a block Hawleys used to own. I wish I didn't resent it so much. It wasn't depression or hard times that wiped us out. All that came from starting to say New Baytown is a pretty town. I turned right on Elm Street instead of left and walked fast up to Porlock, which is cockeyed parallel with High. Wee Willie, our fat constable, would be dozing in his police car on the High, and I didn't want to pass the time of night with him. "What you doing up so late, Heath? Got yourself a little piece of something?" Wee Willie gets lonesome and loves to talk, and then later he talks about what he talked about. Quite a few small but nasty scandals have grown out of Willie's loneliness. The day constable is Stonewall Jackson Smith. That's not a nickname. He was christened Stonewall Jackson, and it does set him apart from all the other Smiths. I don't know why town cops have to be opposites, but they usually are. Stony Smith is a man who wouldn't give away what day it is unless he were on the stand under oath. Chief Smith runs the police work of the town, and he's dedicated, studies the latest methods, and has taken the FBI training in Washington. I guess he's as good a policeman as you're likely to find, tall and quiet, and with eyes like little gleams of metal. If you were going in for crime, the chief would be a man to avoid. All of this came from my going over to Porlock Street to avoid talking to Wee Willie. It's on Porlock that the beautiful houses of New Baytown are. You see, in the early 1800s, we had over 100 whaling bottoms. When the ships came back from a year or two, out as far as the Antarctic or the China Sea, they would be loaded with oil and very rich. But they would have touched at foreign ports and picked up things, as well as ideas. That's why you see so many Chinese things in houses on Porlock Street. Some of those old captain owners had good taste, too. With all their money, they brought in English architects to build their houses. That's why you see so much Adam influence and Greek Revival architecture on Porlock Street. It was that period in England. But with all the fanlights and fluted columns and Greek keys, they never neglected to put a widow's walk on the roof. The idea was that the faithful, homebound wives could go up there to watch for returning ships, and maybe some of them did. My family, the Hawleys, and the Phillipses, and the Elgers, and the Bakers were older. They stayed put on Elm Street, and their houses were what is called early American, peak roofs and shiplap siding. That's the way my house, the old Hawley house, is. And the giant elms are as old as the houses. Porlock Street has kept its gas street lamps, only there are electric globes in them now. In the summer, tourists come to see the architecture and what they call the old world charm of our town. Why does charm have to be old world? I forgot how the Vermont Allens got mixed up with the Hawleys. It happened pretty soon after the Revolution. I could find out, of course. Up in the attic somewhere, there will be a record. By the time my father died, my Mary was pretty tired of Hawley family history, so when she suggested that we store all the things in the attic, I understood how she felt. You can get pretty tired of other people's family history. Mary isn't even New Baytown born. She came from a family of Irish extraction, but not Catholic. She always made a point of that. Ulster family, she calls them. She came from Boston. No, she didn't, either. I got her in Boston. I can see both of us, maybe more clearly now than then, a nervous, frightened Second Lieutenant Hawley with a weekend pass, and the soft, petal-cheeked, sweet-smelling darling of a girl, and triply all of those because of war and textbooks. How serious we were, how deadly serious. I was going to be killed, and she was prepared to devote her life to my heroic memory. It was one of a million identical dreams of a million olive uniforms and cotton prints. And it might well have ended with the traditional Dear John letter, except that she devoted her life to her warrior. Her letters, sweet with steadfastness, followed me everywhere. Round, clear handwriting in dark blue ink on light blue paper, so that my whole company recognized her letters, and every man was curiously glad for me. Even if I hadn't wanted to marry Mary, her constancy would have forced me to, for the perpetuation of the world dream of fair and faithful women. She has not wavered. Not in the transplanting from Boston Irish tenancy to the old Hawley house on Elm Street. And she never wavered in the slow despondency of my failing business, in the birth of our children, or in the paralysis of my long clerkship. She is a waiter. I can see that now. And I guess she had at lengthy last grown weary of waiting. Never before had the iron of her wishes showed through, for my Mary is no mocker, and contempt is not her tool. She has been too busy making the best of too many situations. It only seemed remarkable that the poison came to a head because it had not before. How quickly the pictures formed against the sound of frost-crunching footsteps on the night street. There's no reason to feel furtive walking in the early morning in New Baytown. Wee Willie makes little jokes about it, but most people seeing me walking toward the bay at 3 in the morning would suppose I was going fishing and not give it another thought. Our people have all sorts of fishing theories, some of them secret like family recipes, and such things are respected and respectable. The street lights made the hard white frost on the lawns and sidewalks glint like millions of tiny diamonds. Such a frost takes a footprint, and there were none ahead. I've always, from the time I was a child, felt a curious excitement walking in new, unmarked snow or frost. It's like being first in a new world, a deep, satisfying sense of discovery of something clean and new, unused, undirtied. The usual night folk, the cats, don't like to walk on frost. I remember once, on a dare, I stepped out barefoot on a frosty path, and it felt like a burn to my feet. But now, in galoshes and thick socks, I put the first scars on the glittering newness. Where Porlock crosses Torquay, that's where the bicycle factory is, just off Hicks Street. The clean frost was scarred with long foot-dragged tracks. Danny Taylor, a restless, unsteady ghost, wanting to be somewhere else and dragging there and wanting to be somewhere else. Danny, the town drunk. Every town has one, I guess. Danny Taylor. So many town heads shook slowly from side to side. Good family. Old family. Last of the line. Good education. Didn't he have some trouble at the academy? Why doesn't he straighten up? He's killing himself with booze, and that's wrong, because Danny's a gentleman. It's a shame, begging money for booze. It's comfort that his parents aren't alive to see it. It would kill them, but they're dead already. But that's New Baytown talking. In me, Danny is a raw sorrow, and out of that, a guilt. I should be able to help him. I've tried, but he won't let me. Danny is as near to a brother as I ever had, same age and growing up, same weight and strength. Maybe my guilt comes because I am my brother's keeper, and I have not saved him. With a feeling that deep down, excuses, even valid ones, give no relief. Taylors, as old a family as Hawley's or Baker's or any of the others. In childhood, I can remember no picnic, no circus, no competition, no Christmas without Danny beside me, as close as my own right arm. Maybe if we had gone to college together, this wouldn't have happened. I went to Harvard, luxuriated in languages, bathed in the humanities, lodged in the old, the beautiful, the obscure, indulged myself with knowledge utterly useless in running a grocery store, as it developed. And always I wish Danny could be with me on that bright and excited pilgrimage. But Danny was bred for the sea. His appointment to the Naval Academy was planned and verified and certain even when we were kids. His father sewed up the appointment every time we got a new congressman. 3 years with honors and then expelled. It killed his parents, they say, and it killed most of Danny. All that remained was this shuffling sorrow, this wandering night sorrow, cadging dimes for a pint of Skullbuster. I think the English would say, he's let the side down, and that always wounds the letter down more than the side. Danny's a night wanderer now, an early morning man, a lonely, dragging thing. When he asks for a quarter for Skullbuster, his eyes beg you to forgive him, because he can't forgive himself. He sleeps in a shack in back of the boatworks where the Wilbers used to be shipbuilders. I stooped over his tracks to see whether he was headed home or away. By the scuff of the frost, he was going out, and I might meet him any place. Wee Willie wouldn't lock him up. What would be the good? There was no question where I was going. I'd seen and felt and smelled it before I got out of bed. The old harbor is pretty far gone now. After the new breakwater went in and the municipal pier, sand and silt crept in and shallowed that once great anchorage sheltered by the jagged teeth of the Whitsun Reef. And where once there were shipways and rope walks and warehouses and whole families of coopers to make the whale oil casks, and docks, too, over which the bowsprits of whalers could project to their chainstays and figure or fiddleheads. Three masters they were usually, square-rigged. The aftermast carried square sails as well as boom and gaff spanker, deep-hulled ships built to suffer the years at sea in any weather. The flying jib-boom was a separate spar, and the double dolphin striker served as spritsail gaffs as well. I have a steel engraving of the old harbor chock-a-block, with ships, and some faded photographs on tin, but I don't really need them. I know the harbor, and I know the ships. Grandfather rebuilt it for me with his stick made from a narwhal's horn, and he drilled me in the nomenclature, rapping out the terms with his stick against a tide-bared stump of a pile of what was once the Hawley Dock, a fierce old man with a white whisker fringe. I loved him so much I ached from it. "All right," he'd say in a voice that needed no megaphone from the bridge. "Sing out the full rig, and sing it loud. I hate whispering." And I would sing out, and he'd whack the pile with his narwhal stick at every beat. "Flying jib," I'd sing, whack. "Outer jib, whack. Inner jib, jib, whack, whack. Sing out, you're whispering. Four skysail, four royal, four t'gallantsail, four upper topsail, four lower topsail, foresail, and every one a whack. Main, sing out. Main skysail, whack." But sometimes, as he got older, he would tire. "Belay the main," he would shout. "Get to the mizzen. Sing out now." "Aye, sir." "Mizzen skysail, mizzen royal, mizzen t'gallants, mizzen upper topsail, mizzen lower topsail, crossjack, and spanker. How rigged?" "Boom and gaff, sir." Whack, whack, whack. Narwhal's stick against the waterlogged pile. As his hearing got fuzzier, he accused more and more people of whispering. "If a thing's true, or even if it ain't true, and you mean it, sing out," he would cry. Old Captain's ears may have gone wonky toward the end of his life, but not his memory. He could recite you the tonnage and career of every ship, it seemed like, that ever sailed out of the bay, and what she brought back, and how it was divided. And the odd thing was that the great whaling days were nearly over before he was master. Kerosene he called skunk oil, and kerosene lamps were stink pots. By the time electric lights came, he didn't care much, or maybe was content just to remember. His death didn't shock me. The old man had drilled me in his death as he had in his ships. I knew what to do, inside myself and out. On the edge of the silted and sanded-up old harbor, right where the Hawley Dock had been, the stone foundation is still there. It comes right down to the low tide level, and high water laps against its square masonry. 10 feet from the end, there is a little passage about 4 feet wide, and 4 feet high, and 5 feet deep. Its top is vaulted. Maybe it was a drain one time, but the landward entrance is cemented in with sand and broken rock. That is my place, the place everybody needs. Inside it, you are out of sight, except from seaward. There's nothing at Old Harbor now but a few clammers' shacks. Rattlety things, mostly deserted in the winter. But clammers are a quiet lot anyway. They hardly speak from day's end to end, and they walk with their heads down and their shoulders bowed. That is the place I was headed for. I spent night tide there before I went in the service, and the night tide before I married my Mary, and part of the night Ellen was born that hurt her so bad. I was compelled to go and sit inside there and hear the little waves slap the stone and look out at the sawtooth Whitsun rocks. I saw it lying in bed, watching the dance of the red spots, and I knew I had to sit there. Its big changes take me there. Big changes. South Devon runs along the shore, and there are lights aimed at the beach, put there by good people to keep lovers from getting in trouble. They have to go somewhere else. A town ordinance says that Wee Willie has to patrol once an hour. There wasn't a soul on the beach. Not a soul, and that was odd because someone is going fishing or coming in nearly all the time. I lowered myself over the edge and found the outcrop stone and doubled into the little cave. And I had hardly settled myself before I heard Wee Willie's car go by. That's twice I'd avoided passing the time of night with him. It sounds uncomfortable and silly, sitting cross-legged in a niche like a blinking Buddha. But some way the stone fits me, or I fit. Maybe I've been going there so long that my behind has conformed to the stones. As for its being silly, I don't mind that. Sometimes it's great fun to be silly, like children playing statues and dying of laughter. And sometimes being silly breaks the even pace and lets you get a new start. When I'm troubled, I play a game of silly so that my dear will not catch trouble from me. She hasn't found me out yet, or if she has, I'll never know it. So many things I don't know about my Mary, and among them, how much she knows about me. I don't think she knows about the place. How could she? I've never told anyone. It has no name in my mind except the place. No ritual or formula or anything. It's a spot in which to wonder about things. No man really knows about other human beings. The best he can do is to suppose that they are like himself. Now, sitting in the place, out of the wind, seeing under the guardian lights the tide creep in, black from the dark sky, I wondered whether all men have a place, or need a place, or want one and have none. Sometimes I've seen a look in eyes, a frenzied animal look, as of need for a quiet, secret place where soul shivers can abate, where a man is one and can take stock of it. Of course, I know of the theories of back to the womb and the death wish, and these may be true of some men, but I don't think they're true of me, except as easy ways of saying something that isn't easy. I call whatever happens in the place taking stock. Some others might call it prayer, and maybe it would be the same thing. I don't believe it's thought. If I wanted to make a picture of it for myself, it would be a wet sheet turning and flapping in a lovely wind, and drying and sweetening the white. What happens is right for me, whether or not it is good. There were plenty of matters to consider, and they were jumping and waving their hands for attention like kids in school. Then I heard the slow puttering of a boat engine, a one-lunger, a fishing craft. Her masthead light moved south beyond the Whitsun Rocks. I had to put everything aside until she turned her red and green lights safe in the channel. A local boat to have found the entrance so easily. She dropped anchor in the shallows, and two men came ashore in her skiff. Little wavelets brushed the beach, and the disturbed gulls took time to settle back on the mooring floats. Item. There was Mary, my dear, to think of. Asleep with the smile of mystery on her lips. I hoped she wouldn't waken and look for me, but if she did, would she ever tell me? I doubt it. I think that Mary, for all that she seemed to tell everything, tells very little. There was the fortune to consider. Did Mary want a fortune, or did she want it for me? The fact that it was a fake fortune, rigged by Margie Young Hunt for reasons I didn't know, made no difference at all. A fake fortune was just as good as any, and it is possible that all fortunes are a little fake. Any man of reasonable intelligence can make money if that's what he wants. Mostly it's women, or clothes, or admiration he really wants, and they deflect him. The great artists of finance like Morgan and Rockefeller weren't deflected. They wanted and got money. Just simple money. And what they did with it afterwards is another matter. I've always felt they got scared of the ghost they raised and tried to buy it off. item. By money, Mary meant new curtains, and sure education for the kids, and holding her head a little higher, and, face it, being proud rather than a little ashamed of me. She had said it in anger, and it was true. Item. Did I want money? Well, no. Something in me hated being a grocery clerk. In the army I made captain, but I know what got me into OTC. It was family and connections. I wasn't picked for my pretty eyes, but I did make a good officer, a good officer. But if I had really liked command, imposing my will on others and seeing them jump, I might have stayed in the army, and I'd have been a colonel by now. But I didn't. I wanted to get it over. They say a good soldier fights a battle, never a war. That's for civilians. Item. Marullo was telling me the truth about business, business being the process of getting money. And Joey Morphy was telling it straight, and Mr. Baker and the drummer. They all told it straight. Why did it revolt me and leave a taste like a spoiled egg? Am I so good, or so kind, or so just? I don't think so. Am I so proud? Well, there's some of that. Am I lazy, too lazy to be involved? There's an awful lot of inactive kindness, which is nothing but laziness, not wanting any trouble, confusion, or effort. There is a smell and a feel of dawn long before the light. It was in the air now, a tempering of the wind. A new star or a planet cleared the horizon to eastward. I should know what star or planet, but I don't. The wind freshens or steadies in the false dawn. It really does. And I would have to be going back soon. This rising star was too late to have much of a go before daylight. What is the saying, the stars incline, they do not command? Well, I've heard that a good many serious financiers go to astrologers for instruction in stock purchase. Do the stars incline toward a bull market? Is AT&T influenced by the stars? Nothing as sweet and remote in my fortune as a star. The beat-up tarot deck of fortune-telling cards in the hands of an idle, mischievous woman, and she had rigged the cards. Do the cards incline but not command? Well, the cards incline me out to the place in the middle of the night, and they incline me to give more thought than I wanted to a subject I detested. That's quite a bit of inclining right there. Could they incline me to a business cleverness I never had? To acquisitiveness foreign to me? Could I incline to want what I didn't want? There are the eaters and the eaten. That's a good rule to start with. Are the eaters more immoral than the eaten? In the end, all are eaten, all, gobbled up by the earth, even the fiercest and the most crafty. The roosters up on Clam Hill had been crowing for a long time, and I'd heard and not heard. I wished I could stay to see the sun rise straight out from the place. I said there was no ritual involved with the place, but that is not entirely true. Sometimes on each visit I reconstruct Old Harbor for my mind's pleasure, the docks, the warehouses, the forest of masts and underbrush of rigging and canvas. And my ancestors, my blood, the young ones on the deck, the fully grown aloft, the mature on the bridge. No nonsense of Madison Avenue then, or trimming too many leaves from cauliflowers. Some dignity was then for a man, some stature. A man could breathe. That was my father talking, the fool. Old Captain remembered the fights over shares, the quibbles with stores, suspicion of every plank and keelson, the lawsuits, yes, and the killings. Over women? Glory? Adventure? Not at all. Over money. It was a rare partnership, he said, that lasted more than one voyage and blistering feuds ever afterward, continuing after the cause was forgotten. There was one bitterness old Captain Hawley did not forget, a crime he could not forgive. He must have told me about it many times, standing or sitting on the rim of Old Harbor. We spent a goodly time there, he and I. I remember him pointing with his narwhal stick. "Take that third rock on Whitsun Reef," he said. "Got her? Now line her up with the tip of Porty Point at high water. See it there? Now, half a cable length out on that line is where she lies, at least her keel."
"The Belle Adair?"
"The Belle Adair. Our ship. Half ours. A partnership. She burned at anchor. Burned to the waterline. I never believed it was an accident."
"You think she was fired, sir?"
"I do."
But you can't do that."
"I couldn't."
"Who did?"
"I don't know."
"Why?"
"Insurance."
"Then it's no different now."
"No different."
"There must be some difference."
"Only a single man alone. Only in one man alone. There's the only power, one man alone. Can't depend on anything else."
He never spoke to Captain Baker again, my father told me, but he didn't carry it to his son, Mr. Banker Baker. He wouldn't do that any more than he would burn a ship. Good God, I've got to get home. And I got. I almost ran, and I went up the high street without thinking. It was still dark enough, but the rim of lightness lay on the edge of the sea and made the waves gray iron. I rounded the war memorial and passed the post office. In a doorway, Danny Taylor stood, as I knew he must, hands in pockets, collar of his ragged coat turned up, and his old peaked shooter's cap with the ear flaps turned down. His face was blue-gray with cold and sickness.
"Eth," he said, "I'm sorry to bother you. Sorry. I've got to have some skullbuster. You know, I wouldn't ask if I didn't have to."
"I know. I mean, I don't know, but I believe you." I gave him a dollar bill. "Will that do it?" His lips were trembling the way a child's lips do when he's about to cry.
"Thank you, Eth," he said. "Yes, that will put me away all day and maybe all night."
He began to look better just thinking of it.
"Danny, you've got to stop this. Think I've forgotten? You were my brother, Danny. You still are. I'll do anything in the world to help you."
A little color came into his thin cheeks. He looked at the money in his hand, and it was as though he had taken his first gulp of skullbuster. Then he looked at me with hard, cold eyes.
"In the first place, it's nobody's goddamn business. And in the second place, you haven't got a bean, Eth. You're as blind as I am, only it's a different kind of blindness."
"Listen to me, Danny. What for?"
"Why? I'm better off than you are. I've got my ace in the hole. Remember our country place?
Where the house burned down? Where we used to play in the cellar hole?
You remember it all right. It's mine."
"Danny, you could sell it and get a new start."
"I won't sell it. The county takes a little bit of it for taxes every year. The big meadow is still mine."
"But why won't you sell it?"
"Because it's me. It's Daniel Taylor. As long as I have it, no Christy sons of bitches can tell me what to do, and no bastards can lock me up for my own good. Do you get it?"
"Listen, Danny."
"I won't listen. If you think this dollar gives you a right to preach to me, here, take it back."
"Keep it."
"I will."
"You don't know what you're talking about. You've never been a drunk. I don't tell you how to wrap bacon, do I? Now, if you'll go your own way, I'll knock on a window and get some skullbuster.
Don't forget, I'm better off than you are. I'm not a clerk.
He turned around and put his head in the corner of the closed doorway like a child who abolishes the world by looking away from it. And he stayed there until I gave up and walked on. Wee Willie, parked in front of the hotel, stirred out of his nap and rolled down the window of his Chevrolet.
"Morning, Ethan," he said. "You up early or out late?"
"Both."
"Must have found yourself a fancy piece."
"Sure did, Willie. And Hoorie."
"Now, Eth, don't tell me you'd take up with no streetwalker."
"I swear it."
"Can't believe nothing no more. I bet you was fishing. How's Missus?"
"Asleep."
"That's where I'll be, come shift."
I went on without reminding him that's where he'd been. I walked quietly up my back steps and switched on the kitchen light. My note was on the table a little left of center. I'd swear I left it right in the middle. I put the coffee on and sat waiting for it to perk, and it had just begun to bounce when Mary came down. My darling looks like a little girl when she awakens. You couldn't think she's the mother of two big brats, and her skin has a lovely smell, like new-cut grass, the most cozy and comforting odor I know.
"What are you doing up so early?"
"Well, may you ask. Pleased to know I've been up most of the night. Regard my galoshes there by the door. Feel them for wetness."
"Where did you go?"
"Down by the sea there's a little cave, my rumpled duck. I crawled inside and I studied the night."
"Now wait."
"And I saw a star come out of the sea, and since it had no owner, I took it for our star. I tamed it and turned it back to fatten."
"You're being silly. I think you just got up and that woke me."
"If you don't believe me, ask Wee Willie. I spoke to him. As Danny Taylor, I gave him a dollar."
"You shouldn't. He'll just get drunk."
"I know. That was his wish. Where can our star sleep, sweet fern?"
"Doesn't coffee smell good? I'm glad you're silly again. It's awful when you're gloomy. I'm sorry about that fortune thing. I don't want you to think I'm not happy."
"Don't give it a worry. It's in the cards."
"What?"
"No joke. I'm going to make our fortune."
"I never know what you're thinking."
"That's the greatest difficulty with telling the truth. Can I beat the children a little to celebrate the day before resurrection? I promise to break no bones."
"I haven't washed my face," she said. I couldn't imagine who was rattling around in the kitchen.
When she'd gone up to the bathroom, I put my note to her in my pocket. And I still didn't know. Does anyone ever know even the outer fringe of another? What do you like in there? Mary, do you hear? Who are you in there?
Chapter 4. That Saturday morning seemed to have a pattern. I wonder whether all days have. It was a withdrawn day. The little gray whisper of my Aunt Deborah came to me. "Of course Jesus is dead. This is the only day in the world's days when he is dead. And all men and women are dead too. Jesus is in hell, but tomorrow, just wait until tomorrow, then you'll see something."
I don't remember her very clearly, the way you don't remember someone too close to look at, but she read the scripture to me like a daily newspaper, and I suppose that's the way she thought of it, as something going on happening eternally, but always exciting and new. Every Easter, Jesus really rose from the dead, an explosion, expected but nonetheless new. It wasn't 2,000 years ago to her, it was now. And she planted something of that in me. I can't remember wanting to open the store before. I think I hated every sluggish sloven of a morning. But this day, I wanted to go. I love my Mary with all my heart, in some ways much better than myself. But it's also true that I do not always listen to her with complete attention. When she tells the chronicle of clothes and health and conversations which please and enlighten her, I do not listen at all, so that sometimes